And there it is. Today we're going to be talking about the problem of evil. Not that there is evil in the world, but the atheist argument that because of evil, pain, and suffering in the world, that therefore there is no God. It's something that's talked about on university campuses, even those that are out of the world, even some of your neighbors are coming up with the idea that because of evil, pain, and suffering, that therefore God does not exist. But no. All right. Judges chapter 6, verses 1 through 6, the passage from the Old Testament that talks about this very problem, is on the screen now. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel, and because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made them dens, which are in the mountains, and caves, and strongholds. And so it was, when Israel had sown, that the Midianites came up, and the Amalekites, and the children of the east, even they came up against them. And they encamped against them, and destroyed the increase of the earth, till thou come unto Gaza, and left no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor ass. For they came up with the cattle and their tents, and they came as grasshoppers for multitude, for both they and their camels were without number, and they entered into the land to destroy it. And Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried unto the Lord. For 7 years, Israel was victimized by the Midianites. They came in hordes to drive out the people from the land, to take from them the things that they needed to survive. Israel's crops were destroyed. Their livestock was confiscated, and the people were forced to seek refuge in the dens and caves of the mountains. During this difficult period, the angel of the Lord appeared unto Gideon in Judges 6, verses 12 through 13. And Gideon expresses the idea of our day. If there is a God in heaven, why isn't he doing more for us? And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him and said unto him, The Lord is with thee, thou mighty man of valor. And Gideon said unto him, O my Lord, if the Lord be with us, then why is all this befallen us? And where be all his miracles which our fathers told us of, saying, Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? But now the Lord hath forsaken us and delivered us into the hand of the Midianites. This is the very question that people are asking today. Many are asking, if God is with us, why? Why did my child have to die from cancer? Why was my wife killed in that car wreck? Why was my child molested? Why? Of course, these are all things that are very close to us and things that we want to know the answer to. We want to know the mind of God, else there really is no God. These and 1,000 similar questions could be asked. These questions grip the human heart. Thousands cry for some sort of answer. The problem stated. With many people, the great obstacle to belief in God is the problem of evil and suffering. I recall it dimly, but many years ago there was a tragedy in the life of Mary Tyler Moore. I don't know what all went on. It had something to do with the death of her son. And she came out and said in some news article that she didn't believe in God because he killed her son. Now, I know it's a crazy thing to say if you actually think about it. That's not a reasonable thing to say, that he killed your son, therefore you don't believe in him. But you're just blaming him, but you don't believe in him. It's a circle argument. But that's what she said, and because of that, I'm sure many other people decided, I'm not going to believe in God because of all the evil, pain, and suffering in the world. Many sincere people agonize greatly in an effort to resolve this problem in their minds. Thus, many assume that there cannot be a loving God such as the Bible indicates. This problem is not a new one. It goes way back. 2,000 years ago, a Greek philosopher by the name of Epicurus stated this very same problem. Epicurus argued, "If God wishes to prevent evil but cannot, he is not all-powerful and therefore not God. If God has the power to prevent evil but does not, he's not all good and therefore not God. If God has both the power and desire to prevent evil, why is there evil, pain, and suffering in this world?" And he came to the conclusion, therefore, there is no God. The fallacy of the argument, of course, is the assumption that no good purpose can be served by the allowance of evil and suffering in the world. The truth is, sometimes we need our pain. We need what goes on in our past to push us forward in the future, even though the past may be ugly. We don't even want to think about it. It makes us who we are. We need our pain. The problem stated, no man should be so bold as to think that he can completely understand everything about the problem of suffering. We don't see everything. We don't have the eye of God on the whole creation. Romans chapter 11, verse 33. "For the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out." After reading that passage, how can you conclude that you have a real handle on evil, pain, and suffering? That you have a real handle on the purposes of God? Does God tell you everything? No, he tells you what you need to know. Deuteronomy 29, verse 29. I know this is the preacher's passage, but it's one that's of good use here. "The secret things belong unto the Lord our God, but those things which are revealed belong unto us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law." The secret things belong to God. If he didn't tell you, he didn't mean to tell you. He has that ability to give you exactly what you need to know and leave it to you to study his word, to study his will, and to leave the rest to him. That's part of the trust we have in God. You can't say you have trust for someone and then demand to know every detail of the operation. It simply doesn't work that way. God has revealed to us what we need to know. The things we would like to know but can't, we must accept by faith, knowing that God always does what is right. We simply have to trust him, that he knows what he's doing, that he has our best interests at heart, even though it seems like we're like Job and everything is just going down the rat hole. It may seem like that sometimes, but we have to trust God that he knows what he's doing. Genesis chapter 18, verse 25. "Be that far from thee to do after this manner, to slay the righteous with the wicked." Let's stop right there and give the background. This is Abraham speaking in Scripture. Abraham is looking across the way, Sodom and Gomorrah. The angels that came to him said, it's going to be burned up. And he says, well, Lot's over there. Will you do evil? Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Let's read the whole thing again. "Be that far from thee to do after this matter, to slay the righteous with the wicked, and that the righteous should not be as the wicked, and that be far from thee. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?" That's a rhetorical question. The answer is, of course, the judge of all the earth will do right. That's who he is. He is righteous. And so, Lot escaped from the fire that came on Sodom and the city of the plains. Of course, God will do that which is right. The atheist has a problem when he cries evil, that evil means that there is no God. Because the problem is that if there is no God, there is no way to call something evil. It just becomes your opinion. Well, you might say it's a good opinion, but when the Third Reich says that these people have no right to live, or that these people need to give up their land for us, or that we need to be the masters of all the world, they believed that they were right. And other people did too. Other people said, no, you're not right. Henceforth, there is war. There is no evil without a universal system of justice. That is a system outside of opinion, an objective moral standard. No one can give a universal system of justice but God. It's just not possible. All else is opinion. Some may say, I like mice. Well, I like mice in somebody else's house, if you don't mind. Someone may say, well, I like cockroaches. They are survivors and so many things that you like about them. I like them in the outside, if you don't mind. People have opinions about things. Some people will say, my opinion is better than yours. But it's not an objective moral standard. That's what we're looking for. God, who is love, expresses his love by giving us the freedom to choose. We are given the freedom to choose. And sometimes that is that rides head on with other people's choices. He that loveth not knoweth not God, for God is love. 1 John 4, verse 8. God has given us freedom of choice. Notice Joshua 24, verse 15. He gathers the people together. He knows his time is not long in the world, but he wants to give them something to remember. He says, and if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land ye dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Notice in that last sentence there was a choice made. A choice of service to God by Joshua. And he says to the people, you have a choice too. You can choose to serve those other gods, or you can choose to serve Jehovah. You have to make your choice. Choice, choice, choice. We have free will, and we will exercise it. John 7, verse 17, if any man will do his will, he shall know of the doctrine, whether it be of God, or whether I speak of myself. Choice, choice, choice. We have choice in what we do. That's the idea of will. If any man will do his will, we have the opportunity to do his will. Revelation 22, verse 17, and the Spirit and the Bride say, come. And let him that heareth say, come. And let him that is athirst come. And whosoever will, let him take of the water of life freely. Whosoever will, that means there's a choice. You might not take the water of life. Someone else might not take the water of life. But I'm going to choose it. And all who are wise will choose it. But God has not slavishly programmed us without free will. We are not an automaton. We are not a robot of some sort. No, we do not operate on instinct either. We operate on reason. God has given us that reason so that we may choose. And sometimes those choices prove to cause evil in the world. Where freedom of choice is permitted, there is certainly the possibility that man will make the wrong choices. Wrong choices must entail some adverse consequences. Think about this. If all actions or choices, both good and bad, produce exactly the same effect, how would one ever learn to choose the good and to reject the bad? If it didn't matter what you do, that God ought to make everything right, then what is the purpose of it all? It's clear, therefore, that finite beings with personal willpower must be allowed to suffer the consequences of their wrong choices if they are to learn that the good is to be valued over the bad. In light of this, let's consider several types of suffering in the world. First, there's personal wrong choices. Sometimes we choose poorly. My wife and daughter were watching the Indiana Jones movie about the cup of Christ, and that's still the best line in the whole movie, he chose poorly. We have choices to make, and sometimes those choices cause us to lose. Maybe lose a game. Maybe lose a spouse. Maybe lose a child. maybe lose our freedom because the police come pick us up. We have choices to make, and sometimes we make them poorly. We frequently bring suffering upon ourselves because of the bad decisions that we make. The Bible is full of examples of this. Judges 6 and verse 1. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian 7 years. In the hand of Midian was a bad place to be, because Midian wanted it all. They wanted their crops. They wanted their animals. They wanted everything that they had. They left them in dens, that is, caves, to eke out a living. They weren't merciful at all. 1 Peter 4, verse 15. But let none of you suffer as a murderer, or as a thief, or as an evildoer, or as a busybody in other men's matters. We can suffer, and sometimes it's just our own fault. Suffer as a murderer, commit murder, you're going to suffer. Steal someone's things, they find out about it, you're going to go to jail. Be an evildoer, you're going to be known as an evildoer. If you're a busybody, there are consequences to that as well. If a man steals and goes to prison, can we stop blaming God for evil in the world on that point anyway? A man commits a murder and is executed. Is God to be blamed? Can't we just stop blaming God for our own bad choices? The things that He has expressly warned us about? Can't we do that? Personal wrong choices of others. Sometimes we're affected by the choices of others. You're driving down a highway, and suddenly someone goes to sleep, coming in on the opposite lane. They start veering into your side. That happened to me and my family one time. We had to go drive into the ditch for a bit. But somebody could have been hit head on just as easily as driving into that ditch. I know that in Texas the ditches are not as much as they are around here, but still, it was the ditch, and it was almost someone else's field going through a fence. Personal wrong choices of others cause us pain and suffering. A considerable amount of suffering is caused by the bad choices of those around us. We cannot argue for our freedom of choice while denying it for everyone else. Everyone around us makes personal choices as well, and they may affect you. Whether it's alcohol, whether it's drugs, whether it's words that they use, whether it's laws that they break, it affects us. But God is no respecter of persons. You see the Apostle Peter standing before Cornelius in the city of Caesarea. And Cornelius wants to know what the will of God is through Peter. Then Peter opened his mouth and said, "Of a truth, I perceive that God is no respecter of persons." Up until that day, there was a great divide, a grand canyon, if you will, between Jew and Gentile. You see, the Pharisees believed that the Gentiles were fuel for the fires of hell. They even had ritual baths. They might have been in the marketplace and might have rubbed up against the Gentile, and so they had to take this full-body ritual bath before they were ceremonially clean once again, because they touched the Gentile, or they even might have. And so Peter and Cornelius was there. They were there, and Peter was considering what to do. He remembered the dream he had just had, where God had told him, "Don't call something dirty that I've called clean." And so Peter opened his mouth and said, "Of a truth, I perceive that God is no respecter of persons." If we have freedom of choice, so does everyone else around us. We cannot make and choose, and we cannot require God to keep the evil from the world because someone else might make a bad choice, and it might affect us. That's simply the way things are. We need to remember that this is not a place that is a paradise. God didn't design this world after the expulsion from the garden to be your final home. No, this is a place of preparation, a place of character building, a place of soul making, if you will, a place preparing you for that final place. So, Innocent persons may be killed in a wreck involving a drunk driver. In times of war, many are killed as a consequence of the evil decisions of a few leaders. We sometimes pay the price for others' freedom of choice. Then there are personal wrong choices of former generations, decisions made in time past that affect us even today. If we are to reap the benefits of good labors of generations in the past, and we had someone with the gumption to go out and build roads for us that we still drive on today, sometimes you can't get past people who trust the government and on one hand, and then go out and turn on their lights and drive on the roads, and it's just impossible for me to understand how that happens, but it does. We reap the benefits of the decisions of the past, but we don't want anything evil from them. Can we avoid reaping the evils as well on one of those roads that the government had built? There's a turn that is just too tight, and people start going around it too fast because cars are faster today. And more people, they go through the railing into the ditch on the other side. I know a place around my hometown where there is this one place that's a really tight curve, and more than one person has jumped that railing and gone into the tank on the other side of it. Somebody thought it was a smart decision to put that tight curve there rather than go the extra mile and make it a more gentle curve. People are still reaping the evils of that decision. God warned that rejection of Him would affect generations yet unborn. And so it does. Exodus 20, verses 5 and 6. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them, for I am the Lord thy God. I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. There are consequences because of past decisions, and we need to remember that. There is suffering in our world. In connection with this point, we need to consider diseases. First, disease is ultimately related to man's bad choices. You know, before the first sin, was there any disease? The answer is no. Nothing on record as to disease in the life of Adam and Eve. But after that, it starts showing up. Before Adam and Eve's transgression, they were unaffected by disease. When they rebelled, they were deprived of the tree of life. And we are heirs of the conditions they introduced into the world. Notice Romans 5, verse 12. Wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. It's because of sin that we have disease and things such like. Romans 8, verses 20 through 25. Sorry, it's so small. I should have worked on that one a little bit more. For the creature was made subject to vanity, not willingly, but by reason of him who hath subjected the same hope, the same in hope. Because the creature itself also shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now. Before the first sin, was there any of this groaning and travailing? I say not. It was after sin that this began to occur. And not only they, but ourselves also, which have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting for the adoption, to wit, the redemption of our body. For we are saved by hope, and hope that is seen is not hope, for what a man seeth, why doth he yet hope for? But if we hope for that we see not, then do we with patience wait for it. I guess that's me. Emergency alert, by the way. Maybe someone else has got one, too. All right. One thing about hope. If you can see what you're hoping for, you don't have hope. You already have the thing. And so we on this earth that's dealing with pain, suffering, and evil, we have hope because the scriptures tell us of that better place to come. The whole creation groans because of this. It lets us know that there's something better coming. What about the organisms that we find in our biosphere, if you want to put it that way, in our surroundings that are sometimes harmful? We don't want bacteria on our hands. You know, we have these dispensers in the foyer that we can put something to kill all that bacteria. But if you did that in your insides, you would never have any digestion. We have good bacteria and bad. It facilitates digestion or decomposition of waste materials. Were it not for bacteria, this world would be one huge stinking garbage dump. So it's good and it's bad. But we need it. What about the natural disasters of our day? What causes them? Well, there are mountain ranges, deserts, and varying pressure areas. What caused those things? Well, some that have studied the universal flood claim that the breaking up of the deep caused some of those things, that lifted up those mountain ranges and caused these varying conditions. Human wickedness was the cause of that, because God had to rid the planet of them. Natural law. If someone steps off of a high building, there is one step and then a sudden stop. And because of natural law, they don't float to the floor, nor do they float away into space, but there is regulated natural law, regulated by God. A certain amount of suffering because of that is inevitable. Gravity. I stand over here on the side, and I'm a big, heavy person, and if I were to step out or lean forward, there would be a sudden thump, and I would hurt myself greatly. Blood would be everywhere, and we would be saying, why did it cause that pain and suffering? You didn't have to do that. Well, well-regulated gravity is something that is a force in this world, but is it always evil? Is gravity and inertia and centrifugal force and all those things that we count on every day? Do we want God to shut off his natural laws? You know, the first thing, if God were to decide right now to shut off the natural laws, we would be in darkness. And then we would not be able to hold our seat. Centrifugal force and the lack of gravity would throw us into space. We would be floating, as with this building with us. Kind of be like the Wizard of Oz, floating the house into the air and the people with it. Natural law is good, but when we try to win against it, we lose. Luke chapter 13, verses 4 and 5. Were those 18 upon whom the tower in Siloam fell and slew them, think that they were sinners above all men that dwelt in Jerusalem? I tell you nay, but except ye repent, ye shall all likewise perish. Natural law was in play. Not because of their sin, it was simply natural law. That's what happens when you don't build that building right, when you don't engineer it correctly. Someone may die. I remember this from a television program about the builders of Rome. How that when someone built an arch, that the architect had to stand under the arch. And so he was very careful in how that arch was built. Other people's lives were going to be on the line. Why shouldn't his be? And so if he made a mistake, he was going to feel the pain of it first. He was going to end his life first, because natural law is unforgiving. What blesses us sometimes causes us pain and suffering. We benefit greatly from natural law, but if we violate this law, we suffer. Could you imagine what would happen if God suspended His natural laws? We'd be in darkness, floating, and probably dying very soon. Suppose one's clothes caught on fire. With our pain, would be engulfed before. Without pain, he would be engulfed before he realized what was happening. Pain causes us to go to the doctor. Pain causes us to avoid those things that will hurt us. Pain helps us to develop noble character. Without pain, where would traits like patience and bravery and courage be cultivated? You take someone, a group of people that are in the army, and you have a few of them that are brand new recruits, and you have more that have been there almost all of their adult lives. They have been in countless battles, and they have felt the pain of bullets and wounds, and they have smelled the smoke, and they have withstood privation. And which one do you expect to lead the troop up the hill? The brand new recruit who's never felt anything wrong? Who is going to have the courage? Who is going to have the noble character? Who is going to care for someone else? Who is going to get the job done? The one that has felt the pain. The one that knows how to deal with it. The one that knows that he's going to survive it or die. It's not going to be that big a problem. The one that knows how to deal with it. That's the one that has the benefits of suffering. There are spiritual benefits in various many passages for us to look at to tell those benefits. 2 Chronicles 33, verses 10 through 12. Do you remember the king by the name of Manasseh? He was the king that had the longest reign of all the kings of Judah. And he was an evil king. He was one that they said that the streets of Jerusalem ran with blood during his time until... And the Lord spake to Manasseh and to his people, but they would not hearken. Wherefore the Lord brought upon them the captains of the host of the king of Assyria, which took Manasseh among the thorns and bound him with fetters and carried him to Babylon. And when he was in affliction, he besought the Lord his God and humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers. Let's argue. Was suffering good for him? With an eternal viewpoint, yes, it was. It was a good thing that he suffered. And he didn't just suffer a little bit. Notice what it says once again. Took Manasseh among the thorns and bound him with fetters and carried him to Babylon. And when he was in affliction, do you believe the Bible writer intended to make like it was some light thing? I can't see that here myself. When he did this, he besought the Lord his God and humbled himself greatly before the Lord God of his fathers. The benefits of suffering certainly are seen in this passage. Psalm 119, verse 67. The psalmist writes, "Before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now have I kept thy word." Verse 71. "It is good for me that I have been afflicted, that I might learn thy statutes." We all have to learn our lessons, don't we? We all have to learn that which the Lord would have us do. I'm doing it wrong? What do I need to do, Lord? So you search the Scriptures to see what the Lord would have you to do. Romans 8:28. "And we know that all things work together for good, to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose." Where is the suffering in that? It says all things. All things work together for good. And so the benefits of suffering are seen in the New Testament as well. 2 Corinthians 4, verses 16 and 17. "For which cause we faint not, but though our outward man perish, yet the inward man is renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory." Now, light affliction, this is a figure of speech here. And we know this, that Paul is downplaying the affliction by comparison to the eternal glory. But consider the life of the Apostle Paul. Consider what he went through, the beatings. He was stoned once and left for dead, night and a day in the deep. He was ill because of his travels and many other things that he went through in order to be crucified for Christ. The benefits of suffering. Sorry, this is so small as well. I'll try not to do that again the next time. 2 Corinthians 12, verses 7 through 10. And lest I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of the revelations, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh. Notice, given to me a thorn in the flesh. The messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. For this thing I besought the Lord thrice, that it might depart from me. And he said unto me, My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. The benefits of suffering. God says to Paul, there are great benefits in suffering. It keeps you where I need you. It keeps you in that place where I can be glorified and not you. Hebrews 12, verses 5 through 13. And ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. If ye endure chastening, God dealeth with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the father chasteneth not? Chastening is a form of suffering, is it not? But this is for our good. But if ye be without chastisement, whereof are all are partakers, then are ye bastards, and not sons. Furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? For they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure. But he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. Now, no chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. Wherefore lifteth the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. Have a big block of marble up here. Somebody with some skill, not me, somebody with some skill up here chipping away at the figure therein. Now, you're doing damage to that piece of marble, aren't you? You're chipping away at the integrity of it. But under the skilled hand of a master sculptor, finally you have something that is worth hundreds and thousands of times what that block of marble was worth. Because of someone chipped away at you. Sometimes we look at the things that we go through as, oh, poor, pitiful me. But in the final analysis, we need that chastening from the Father. We need the discipline that we receive, that we apply to ourselves when we see we need to go in a better way. God herds us, I believe, herds us at times to do certain things of our lives. I believe that if God had not, I would not be standing here today. And I'm pretty sure that most preachers that will ever come before you will say the same thing. That because of God's chastening, they are where they are today. James chapter 1, verse 12. Blessed is the man that endureth temptation, for when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord hath promised to them that love him. Benefits of suffering. We can see it clearly in the mind of James. In the midst of suffering, we must realize, this is a quote from Job 3, verse 17, there the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary be at rest. Job was in pain. All over his body were these sores. And yet he had thoughts of what was to come, that there was a better place. Even though he was in pain in his life, he knew there was a place coming where there was rest. Imagine having sores all over you and trying to sleep at night. or trying to get a little bit of peace during the day. It simply was not going to happen. Of course, we can see Revelation 21, verses 1 through 5, and the benefits of suffering, you simply can't go to a better place than this. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. And he that sat upon the throne said, Behold, I make all things new. And he said unto me, Write, for these words are true and faithful. The benefits of suffering, if you overcome in this life, and of course he was writing to those churches that were being persecuted at the time, telling them to overcome, if you overcome, there is a place of tremendous beauty, a place where you will be relieved. You will be relieved to know that God will wipe away all tears from your eyes. No more death, no more sorrow, no more crying, no more pain, for the former things are passed away. You will not be affected by the natural law. You will not be affected by other people's choices. You will be affected by what God says, and what God says alone. What should our attitude be towards suffering? Shall we say, bring it on? I don't think any of us can bring that off. But what if it happens? And they departed from the presence of the council, rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer shame for his name. They were beaten and sent away, saying, don't preach in his name anymore. The apostles refused that counsel. They said, we ought to obey God rather than men. They had conviction, and so they suffered. What should be our attitude toward suffering? 1 Peter 2, verses 19 through 23. For this is thankworthy if a man from conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongfully. For what glory is it if when ye be buffeted for your faults, ye shall take it patiently? But if when ye do well and suffer for it, ye take it patiently, this is acceptable with God. For even hereunto were ye called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example, that ye should follow his steps. You would think the Son of God, coming down from the right hand of the throne of God, would be exempt from suffering. But he wasn't. In fact, he became an example for us, how we should deal with that suffering. We should look forward and not behind. We shouldn't be constantly harping about the suffering of the past, but be ready for what that suffering trained us for in the future. What should our attitude be towards suffering? Speaking of Christ, Peter said, who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. Suffering is a small thing compared to heaven. Romans 8, verse 18, For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. Remember who is talking. Remember who is writing. The Apostle Paul, who was crucified with Christ. He said, Nevertheless I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. He did follow Christ in his sufferings. Though not crucified, he was beaten many times, stoned and left for dead, and on it goes. I heard a story one time about a missionary that went to a king. I want to spread my teachings among your people. The king heard the teachings of this missionary and said, You know, I don't think my followers will, my citizens will hear your teachings, but because of your scars, I think they'll be impressed by your scars, and so I'm not going to let you in. Impressed by the scars. The scars of the Apostle Paul should impress us too. That when he received those scars, He counted them not to be compared to the glories to come. The results of handling suffering properly. If we suffer, we shall also reign with Him. If we deny Him, He also will deny us. We will reign with Him. For some of us, that's quite a contrast to the place we are in life. We don't have the privilege today that those that reign do. We don't have the wealth. We don't have the clout. We don't have the carte blanche, if you will. We can go anywhere and do anything. But we can look to the future. If we suffer, we shall also reign with Him. James 1 and verse 12. Blessed is the man that endureth temptation, for when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord hath promised to them that love Him. Compare Psalm 1 to this passage, and you'll see some wonderful things. Today, we have choices to make. What are we going to believe about God? Does God exist? Are we going to say that because of evil, pain, and suffering, that we can't imagine a good thing that pain will do for us because we make that decision for God, that we're going to just write Him off, that He doesn't exist, that we won't believe Him, we won't honor Him, we won't be saved by Him? That's a choice many make. But today, I ask you to make a different choice, that you recognize that the pain and suffering we often live with, is for our benefit. That if we kick our shins against the furniture, that we learn not to do that again. Kind of like the man that went to the doctor said, "Doc, when I do this, it hurts." Doc says, "Well, don't do that." God teaches us that all the time. Is it not for our good that He does that? Can you imagine the character of the people that you've left behind, those that have gone on before, without their suffering, without them having gone through the Great Depression or World War II? Can you imagine the kind of character that they would have without those things? Some of you have gone through some hard times as well. Don't you need that character that you gained? That ability to just marshal on? Don't you need it? Didn't God give you some good things in your pain and suffering? Decide that God does exist, and that He is a rewarder of them that diligently seek Him. Hebrews 11, verse 6. This hour, if you've not been baptized for the remission of your sins, acknowledging God includes obeying Him. Obeying Him and giving Him your life, that you can entrust everything to Him, that you're going to go to heaven with Him, that you're going to, on this earth, as best as you can, you're going to do the things that He wants you to do. If you're going to do that, be baptized for the remission of your sins. He commands it. If you've once been baptized and have decided in time past that it's just not worth it, it's time to turn back. God has blessed you with so many things, even evil, pain, and suffering. If we can assist you in your obedience, won't you come and sit on one of these front pews as we stand, as we sing?